You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast. It's a particularly special books podcast today because I've had to find two chairs for my guests. I have two guests today. Jenny Bristow, formerly associate of the Centre for Parenting Culture Studies at the University of Kent and now lecturer in the School of Psychology, Politics and Sociology at Canterbury Christchurch University. And my other guest is the man who reviewed her book for us, David Willetts, an early career academic at King's College London, but he may be more familiar to our listeners from his previous job, Minister of State for Universities and Science from 2010 to 2014. Now he is visiting professor at the Policy Institute and also a board member at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Now, I do have to tell you some other things about both them and myself. I'm Karen Shook, books editor. I was born in 1962, the year of the Cuban Missile Crisis. David was born in Birmingham in 1956, the year of the Suez Crisis. And Jenny was born in 1975, the year that Margaret Thatcher became the first female leader of the Conservative Party. The reason I'm giving these details is not not because I've lost my mind as to how I should present academics to our listeners, but because of the subject of our conversation today, the baby boomers, generational conflict, intergenerational rapprochement. That is our subject. Jenny's book is Baby Boomers and Generational Conflict. And when I needed it reviewed, obviously, I would go to an academic with experience in the field. Not every academic with experience in the field has also been a Minister of State. I chose David Willetts, A, because he very graciously said yes, and also because, most importantly, he's the author of a highly influential, best-selling, and critically acclaimed book of scholarship on intergenerational equity, The Pinch, How the Baby Boomers Took Their Children's Future and Why They Should Give It Back. And now I'm going to give the chair back to my guests. Jenny, were you surprised as an academic, obviously looking at academic literature on the subject, to read a work this scholarly from a politician, and more importantly, a politician who was just about to take his greatest role in Parliament? And why do you think it became so influential?
I was surprised. I think The Pinch is a very, very interesting book, which speaks to a lot of problems that I think a lot of people are concerned about. And picks up on a lot of issues that I've been concerned about as well in my own work on looking at families and parenting culture and problems of generations in general. I really like The Pinch on one level, but then I think the reason it became very
phenomenon.
Iconic, if you like, in 2010 was because it was part of a kind of a wider discussion about the problem of a particular generation. So where a lot of social problems were being talked about, but they were kind of being laid at the door, if you like, of the baby boomer generation. And I think that sort of has fueled this kind of narrative of boomer blaming, some people have called it, which, you know, I think doesn't really do justice to the scope of the book.
It's a very wide-ranging book. I mean, there's everything from tables of net family income to A Clockwork Orange to David riding his bicycle in Birmingham without parental supervision as a child. And it's beautifully written. I was surprised. I don't read politicians' books and generally come away thinking this.
Absolutely. I mean, it is the book of a polymath. It's a wonderful book to read, and it is it covers the kind of wide range of ground and disciplines that actually you do get in a lot of the good writing on generations, because it does bring in historical discussions and demography and cultural examples and all of those kind of things. So I think it's it was a very interesting synthesis, if you like, of how the problem of generations appeared at the time when it was published.
Now, David, The Pinch wasn't the only book on this subject published in 2010 by a public figure, but it was pretty clearly the most scholarly. And it seemed to me that it reflects the fact that you've been studying and speaking about this issue for some years prior to that. It wasn't suddenly in 2010 where you thought, I've got to set the public agenda. You'd been speaking and thinking about this for a long time.
Well, it was almost by chance that in the Shadow Cabinet, I had first of all been the Shadow Secretary of State for Work and Pensions and spent a lot of my time trying to get my head around pensions and pensions issues. And then I was moved over to education, various roles in education, Shadow Secretary of State for Education, and then universities when the two departments were split. So I had spent the best part of a decade, more than a decade, with all the frustrations of opposition, but thinking about pensions and education. And you increasingly saw the connections, and that's really what got me interested in intergenerational issues. It was the basis on which people pay into a pension, and in one sense they're paying into a pension for themselves that they will enjoy in the future. But a lot of the pension system is actually an exchange now, in which workers now are actually paying for the pensions of pensioners now in return for an expectation that when they're pensioners, a future generation of workers will be paying them. And then, of course, it's, well, and why do we fund people's education, and to what extent can you expect people privately to pay for their education? So that's really what promoted it, and that was a decade or more in those two roles.
Were you surprised that the zeitgeist, I mean, obviously there are probably agents and publishers who are saying, oh, there's no zeitgeist involved here, we've been planning this for ages, but there were loads of other books discussing this from a variety of perspectives.
Yes,
at that time.
I was surprised, because I mean, I'm very pleased with how it's gone, but actually at the time I thought it was quite a risk. I thought it might be thought to be very eccentric. And although there's quite a lot of debate of all this in America, I could not find a kind of major British public policy book since the war that looked at Britain and changes in Britain from the perspective of the relative size and power and affluence of different generations. So I thought, am I barking up completely the wrong tree? And the fact that it, I think it did touch a chord, and then it was followed by several other books, but obviously, you know, people who have been thinking independently along the same lines, I think that did give me confidence. I think we are onto something. And I guess reading Jenny's book, which I greatly enjoyed, and Jenny's book is about kind of the cultural phenomenon of generational
people writing
exchange
about it,
or generational conflict. I think it is a very interesting cultural phenomenon. But my disagreement with Jenny is I think there is something out there happening in, if I may use a very naive expression, the real world. I think the fact that you have got, we had in 1946-47, we had 1 million babies born. And then in 1964, we had 1 million babies born. And at no point in between did we have fewer than 800,000 babies born. And since the mid-60s, we've only just now got back up to having 800,000 babies born. That affects lots of real things. I mean, if you're running a school, you certainly notice it. If you're running a university, you certainly notice it. If you're a democratic politician appealing to voters, you certainly notice it. If you're thinking of house building, you notice it. So my view is that there are indeed a set of cross-cutting, interesting cultural issues. But what really prompted the book was just the experience that this large generation had ended up owning most of the pension assets and owning most of the houses, the two main assets that constitute our personal wealth. And it was proving very hard for successive generations to acquire either of those assets. So I'm willing to join in with Jenny in a proper discussion of all the cultural issues. But I hope in the course of this, she might say there is something real there as well. It is not simply an invented cultural phenomenon.
Well, Jenny, would the argument be that you're not denying that, you know, there was a demographic surge, or that there will be pressures on services or so on, but that the focus of your study was to say, yes, given that, it would be interesting to see what's written about it and the discourse and the way that people talk about it. Just like if we're talking about immigration, I would think it would be interesting to say, have people's views or what they say about immigrants changed over time? I mean, some of the things you highlight, Jenny, phrases from UK and US, the commentariat, if you will, public intellectuals, authors and stuff, the silver tsunami, Boomergeddon, that's my favourite because it's the most horrible. The me generation, the party's over, the greedy generation, the jilted generation, of course, that came about in a book written by self-styled members of the jilted generation. Time magazine, as you say, in 2006, had a cover line calling them balding, wrinkled and stoned. I mean, these phrases are horrible. Speaking as someone who is only technically a baby boomer, obviously it has nothing to do with me, but... And of course, you're from the jilted generation, but don't you find the nature of the way it's being discussed quite peculiar?
Well, I do. I find it problematic from a kind of a policy and sort of discourse point of view, the way that you're having this kind of self-conscious mobilisation of generational conflict. I mean, that's what I was looking at through my study of the media discourse. And it is a media analysis.
So you think they were stirring up hatred of mother against
child? Yes, and my study was looking at why that was, how that came about, because I don't think someone just thought, ha-ha, here's a really good idea for the hell of it. Let's have a go at the baby boomers. And I tracked it. The discourse in the media over the past 26 years, and found that, you know, it does go both ways. At certain times, the boomers are like really great. You know, in the 1990s, everyone loved the boomers. You know, they were going to save the world and all of that, and all of the kind of cultural changes that they were associated with and
represented. People enthusiastic about Clinton being elected and saying, wow, the first guy to play saxophone.
And then New Labour, and some of you had a sort of more muted version of that discourse then. And then when New Labour left, you kind of got like, well, Blair is everything that's wrong with the boomer generation. And it coincided with a turn against what this generation was seen to represent. Now, I think a lot of this discussion was actually cultural. I think it's and the point that I make very strongly in the book is that part of the narrative about the boomers, I think, is a reaction against the 60s. So it's actually a narrative about the problems of the 60s and the legacy of the 60s as a cultural shift.
And that we're not so sure that all these supposedly wonderful changes at the time have all been for the best.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, and it's perfectly valid to critique the 60s. But I think to kind of put it onto a group of people in the way that the discourse often does, and sort of make a generation kind of personally responsible for those changes, I think is rather unfair. But, I mean, in relation to David's point, I think our central disagreement really is about the significance of demography in all of this and demographic changes, because obviously there was a baby boom. In fact, there were two, you know, as you point out in your book. And there couldn't have been a concept of the baby boomer had there not been that demographic boom, or indeed the economic boom that happened when, you know, these kids were born. So there's no intention on my part to deny anything about demographic changes or the importance of demography when you're developing social policy, for example, you know, working out how many school places you need. But I don't think demographic changes determine things to quite the degree that David kind of argues that they do. So for me, you know, when looking at reality, say, well, there is a reality, and all the problems that I discuss in my book are real social problems. But what I'm looking at is how these problems, which are discussions about the recession, about the problems of the welfare state, you know, all these kind of wider social problems, how these become framed through a kind of a cultural narrative of the problem of the baby boomer, if that makes sense. So it's about the interplay between culture and everything else that's going on, that to me is what I mean when I talk about how this generation is constructed as a social problem.
Yeah, and I would say to that, look, I mean, there are some demographers who get carried away, and there's that famous expression, demography is destiny, which is sometimes attached to Richard Easterlin and sometimes attributed to Auguste Comte and lots of other thinkers in between. So you can get carried away, but I do think that the very fact of being a big generation does matter. And what's interesting, and I think it is an interesting way in which the debate has changed, is that the assumption used to be that being a big generation was bad news, and it was crowded, and you're going to have more competition, and that I would, insofar as there was a view in 20th century demography, is that that was a sort of bad deal, and it has played out rather differently. That being a big generation has worked out to be a good deal, and I think it's a very worthwhile question to ask people: would you like to have been born in a big generation or a small generation? And as a result of myself being slap bang in the middle of the baby boom, between the two peaks of the baby boom. So what do you, I mean, I now find, you know, the Rolling Stones are still on tour. The latest cinema film advert I've just seen is The Man from U.N.C.L.E. I mean, all these, just about every single TV or media or film program of my youth is being replayed, or the band are still on tour, because there's so many of us that we'll keep them all going. Now, I think that being big, I think, has ended up meaning you've got power, including economic and political power. Now, how they've used that power, I think part of why the atmosphere has swung is that it has played out, and it wasn't clear in the 1990s, but it is now clear that just in this brutal reality of getting a house or getting a pension, in both cases, the boomers have done very well for themselves, and sadly, it is tougher for the younger generation. And now, why the baby boomers have done that, I don't think they are, are a deliberately evil, selfish group. I think some of the rhetoric that Jenny cites in her book is clearly misplaced. But I don't think that the boomers were aware enough of their obligation to pass things on to the next generation. And my book is really an attempt to remind people that I think the most important form of the social contract is an intergenerational contract. And I was really writing it for those incredibly decent people in my former constituency, in the Residents Association, who whenever we had a planning application to build a new estate or a new set of houses on the field on the edge of the current estate, all those people would turn up to the protest meeting, and they were almost all aged over 40 or 50. They'd almost all got a house of their own, and their main purpose of their protest was to stop people putting up more houses alongside the estate of houses that had been built for them by a previous generation only 40 years ago. And that...
A poorer post-war generation who nevertheless found the money to do so.
Correct. So there is a problem there. So I don't think it is just a sort of matter of tracking cultural changes. Interesting though there are, I do think there is a real problem.
One of the things I loved about the beginning of this book, and it reminded me that although I thought I got a wide liberal arts education studying English literature at the University of Toronto, it clearly wasn't quite wide enough. Reading your description of the difference in the nuclear family in England across centuries and the impact in the Anglophone world, the difference of that versus countries where the extended family was much more important, and how hard it is, as you point out, to institute liberal democracy in places where there isn't that tradition that, yes, you've got your mother and father and grandparents and they look after you, but you need to look beyond an uncle for a job. You need to trust in the rule of law. All of these things that I found it fascinating, and I thought maybe I should have done PPE. I would have known this. However, what I found quite interesting is, if this is true, part of the reason that our society is the way it is was that we could trust social and governmental structures beyond our immediate family. What are we like now when people say, you know, I've got to think of my kids? They think of themselves as their own mini welfare state because they cannot trust that there will be a pension. You know, I know it's not good to buy a council flat or to buy to let or to hike up the rent for the students staying in the basement of the flat I have, but I've got to think of my kids. Surely you, of all people, would, you know, being so aware of the difference of the small nuclear family and how that impacted on English society and you know, the rest of the Anglophone world, would you not say that where we are now, where £9.6 billion goes to private landlords from the public purse to pay for social housing, to pay for rent for people on benefits, where the Exchequer, I think it's been estimated that that tax relief on mortgages costs £13 billion. Would you not say that actually when we're talking about baby boomers being greedy, what we're talking about is... perhaps predominantly baby boomers, but we're talking about asset owners and a system that supports them and means that people are who are not on the property ladder for whatever reason are missing out. Should you not maybe have focused on perhaps instead of intergenerational equity, maybe not making it so easy to become a property magnet at the expense of the state and poorer people?
Well, there are lots of ways in which you can kind of analyse British society and the inequalities within it. And you can look between difference between people who own lots of property and people who don't own property, look between people who are well paid and not well paid. There are lots of other, you could look at it by gender, you could look at it by ethnic background. And there are literally hundreds of books looking at British society from all those perspectives. I think that the generational perspective does help. I think it does add some real information and some real value. And compared with the other kind of perspectives, such as the one you've given, it just wasn't being recognised or addressed. And I actually think that's part of the problem. I agree with Jenny. I don't think that this baby boomer generation are somehow sort of fundamentally more selfish people. I do think that the language of obligations to generate the fact that we are beneficiaries of what previous generations who are less affluent did for us, and we have an obligation to pass things on to future generation. I thought that kind of language, especially in the area where I was active, politics, had largely disappeared. The intergenerational argument wasn't being expressed. And going back to that meeting with a residents association in my constituency, but the only way that you could win the case for the more housing was by saying previous generations allowed this field where your houses now stand to be built on so that you could have a house. We have a similar obligation because your children or grandchildren are not going to be able to get a house unless you do the same thing for them, and you will expect them to do it. That is what holds the country together. And I found that, and this is why I'm not a pessimist actually, they responded to that argument, but that the language of politics had become very thin and people weren't expressing political ideas as an obligation between the generations.
Is your argument, Jenny, essentially that this narrative, you know, sort of going down the line of what I was mentioning, that you've said this is a top-down narrative mm-hmm. rather than a ground-up? Mm-hmm. I would like to hear you justify that, because I think the reason, I mean, this is a David's book is beautifully titled. It makes you want to read it and think, oh, yes, are they doing that? If that was only a top-down narrative, if it didn't have traction, it wouldn't have been picked off the shelves. It would just say, well, ludicrous. Why don't you say, why don't you say that my dog has stolen our children's future? That does resonate with people. But is it resonating with people because they're not aware of the class issues or the inequality issues involved? Or, how can you prove to me that it's only just Will Hutton and Melanie Phillips and people at the Groucho talking about this?
Well, I mean, one of the many further studies that I would love to do would be actually to look at the extent to which ideas about generational conflict have become internalised by people, you know, in a sense, how this narrative is thought of by, you know, younger generations themselves and baby boomers. Anecdotally, people kind of talk about it all the time, you know.
But you pointed out that
the world
like
is full
Sarah
of guilty
Vine
baby boomers.
And,
yeah, you know, right. They're always apologising to me. Okay? It's
their
all right.
Their parents, mostly. Yeah. They have to
I don't
apologize
begrudge you your free orange juice. You know, it's fine.
And the milk until, yeah.
And, you know, and I think and my one of my concerns, and very genuine concerns, about the impact of this kind of this discourse, because I think these discourses do have an impact, is that I think it does give young people a sort of script where if they want to they can kind of say, well, look, my future's already been taken, you know, I can't, there's nothing I can do,
it's
all
unfair.
Your fault, it's yeah, it's so unfair, you know, and so I think that is problematic. I mean, what I in relation to the top-down narrative point, I mean, I think that when I looked at how this had developed, I did think it was very, very interesting, because actually it developed first in the States and then over here, yeah, David's nodding, you know, that there are very similar kind of big similarities between the discourses, which yeah, reflect cultural and, you know, other similarities between Britain and America. It seems that what you have is, it rather than something being a kind of a concern amongst the world at large, and, you know, people fighting for people to take interest in it, and coming from pressure groups, and then, you know, finally you end up with the government taking an interest. When I was looking at this, all the pressure groups, I mean, there's not many of them, have been very recently established. So, for example, the Intergenerational Foundation was established in, I think, 2011. You know, and a lot of these arguments had already been, you know, played out. And what you also get a sense is, so there's that aspect of it, you also get the sense that people are kind of aware. So even while the script is there and people might kind of make use of it, at the same time, they are aware that there's a limit to generation bashing. You know, you love your parents, you're going to get old someday. You know, I mean, I think there is this sort of intuitive understanding that people have that the future, your own personal future, is one of an older person. OK, so if you are going to justify for example, sacking the old people to get rid to make room for the new people, having a go at old people because youth is really important. You know what? In 20 years' time, you're going to be that person. And I think this is what's very interesting to me, because where I really, really do agree with David is that I think the sociology of generations is a fantastic field. And it is something that is only kind of coming up again to being looked at. And I, that's one of the reasons I really appreciate The Pinch as kind of bringing that field into public discourse, if you like. But I think it has to be done sensitively. I think it has to be discussed sensitively, because you you can end up very quickly with sort of assumptions about where the polarities are, if you like, you know, old against young, or, you know, this idea that there's this kind of conflict within families, or, you know, any of these other tensions, which when you look at it, I think it's not as clear cut as that.
I mean, I agree with Jenny about the importance of these type of exchanges, implicit or sometimes more explicit, between generations. I mean, and there's that great bumper sticker, be nice to your kids, they choose your nursing home. You know, we've all got to remember these things. I'm sorry to hark back to the evidence, but you see, the reason why I do think that the young people are not just having a whinge, I think there's a real problem, is the two main assets that people have, your house. First of all, it is manifestly much, the amount of house building in Britain in the last 10 or 15 years has been incredibly low compared with what we had post-war. And it has left a gap in the quality of housing, the amount of space that people live in, the amount of money they have to set aside for rent.
Was that a failure of your government and the preceding government?
I think it is a failure of successive governments. And I know it's very high on David Cameron and agenda and George Osborne and Greg Clark, because it is a nation that has been building something over 100,000 houses a year when it needs manifestly a multiple of that. And when after the war, as you were saying earlier, in conditions of real austerity, we were building 300,000 a year, that's a failure. And then secondly, on pensions, which I did really work on for quite a while, and there what I observed is that the pension entitlements of the boomers had been protected in ever more demanding and onerous legislation, with the result that the trade-off, the intergenerational trade-off, was they got a lot of security for their pension, but at the price of making the provision of a company pension so onerous and expensive that companies pulled out of that, and there were no pensions. And so you've now got literally younger workers in companies who are working to plug deficits in company pension schemes of which they are not a member, because it's only reserved for the older workers. So I'm sorry to say this, I just genuinely do think that, as well as all these interesting cultural currents and what's being said in America, I just think there is, and this is the sort of simple-minded former politician to me, there is a genuine issue. And
maybe you should have called your book We Need to Talk About Pensions.
Well, that might not have sold quite so well.
Because pensions is a genuine issue. And housing. I mean, yeah. I completely agree. We need more houses. I mean, the issue isn't that the baby boomers are buying these second houses because they don't trust their pensions, for the reasons that you've just suggested, actually. It's a fairly rational kind of thing that people are doing. Is that there is this kind of massive crisis in housing stock and an overinflation of housing in terms of its worth to the economy, which is a terrible way to run things.
Yep.
So I agree with that. And my point about the relationship with the cultural narrative is that this is a real problem. OK, but it is then being expressed through a discussion about the problem of the baby boomers. And I'm saying it's not the baby boomers that are the problem, it's the houses.
Yeah. Though I would say that when you look at then the distribution, and since my book came out, there has been much more data now available and much more sophisticated analysis than I was able to do or had at my disposal. I'm afraid it does show that if you were trying to analyse this, going back to your original challenge of kind of, well, what about a class analysis, or, you know, what about a gender analysis or an ethnic analysis? What screams out at you is a cohort analysis. There are some cohorts that have done very well, on average, very well, and others who've done, and other cohorts, the younger cohort, who are doing far less well. And whenever I say this, I get two kinds of letters back. One is someone who was born like me in 1956 and so then had this incredibly tough life and haven't ended up owning a house or whatever, to which I say there are always those individual stories, I'm talking narratives. And the other thing, which is very important, is I have very sweet letters in neat copper plate handwriting on Basildon bond paper in Biro from someone aged 87 saying, I've had a very tough life, Mr. Willetts. Why do you think that I've somehow been the beneficiary? So it is very important to make it clear. The cohort analysis does show those people born roughly 45 to 65, we do seem to have ended up doing quite well for ourselves. And I think, I hope that just the very fact we're having this conversation, I would be disappointed if it went the way Jenny says. It could, Jenny's right to warn, it could end up as generation bashing. Equally, it could be a precondition for sorting it out. It could be getting people to think, yes, I'm a baby boomer, I've benefited from previous generations, I do have a bigger obligation to the future generations than I've been recognising so far. And then you'd have some progress.
Well, do you think this generation that had socialised medicine, that had free higher education, free school, many other benefits, perhaps a decent pension, perhaps a union at work and a decent wage. Did they get too much? Should your children not hope for that much? My argument would be, so why are we being encouraged to bash the baby boomers? Is it because we should see what they got as outrageously greedy? Should it be outrageously greedy not to be living on 60 quid a week? It seems to me that being able to have a council house should not be seen as a ridiculous thing. Is your argument that, well, they were really being greedy? And how could they have chosen it themselves anyway? It happened.
I think in some respects they are now being greedy, and the greed isn't quite in the way you describe it. The greed is when you've got the view out over the field because you're on the edge of the estate, not accepting that someone is going to be able to build and affect your view, things like
right.
that. I do, and of course, by the way, now please you raise this. I get all the time, of course, hang on, you are the Minister for Universities. We had the big increase in fees and loans. Your book was supposed to be a warning, not a training manual. You know, what have you done? What have you done?
Well, David, you're giving me some great, I'll just write this down.
That's enough. And on that, I have to say, of course, as you know, the students don't pay up front. And I would argue that there, one of my aims was to ensure that the younger generation, students, had a well-resourced higher education, and there was no way that with increasing numbers of people going to university, you're going to get the increased public expenditure to do that. So my justification would be it was actually to ensure more cash went into universities for student education, which is what has transpired. But I know, and you can certainly all the big issues in politics today, you don't sort of get a bar, you don't get exempted from them by looking at it from a generational perspective. But I just think it helps us look at them in a slightly richer, more diverse way.
Do you think the boomers had it too good?
I think that some of the things that the boomers have ended up doing have been sadly at the disadvantage of the younger generation. And I would say that they voted them. I have to say, I'm afraid pensions is the most vivid example. They've ended up with pensions over-regulated and become such an absolute property right that no advanced country is going to be able to run a pension scheme like that in the long run. So what you do, it's a bit like the partners in Goldman Sachs converting it once into a limited company. And, you know, if you take a partnership and convert into a limited company, the people who are the partners at the time gain all the benefits, mm-hmm. gain all the wealth that has been created by previous generations of partners, and it isn't open to future generations to have anything like it. So, yeah, I do think in some occasions we cashed in our chips to get a benefit that was then not going to be available to future generations, and I have to say that the company pension is the most conspicuous example of that.
And what about public sector pensions? Speaking of narratives, I hear the phrase gold-plated pensions. Now, I wonder how, as a nursing assistant, the pension you're going to get is gold-plated. It worries me. Would you not want your children to have a pension at least as good as that?
I want my kids to have a decent pension, a good pension, but by the time you look at all the protections that were added, and they were added over 10 or 20 years, there was never a moment of an explicit debate how demanding should they be. By the time you've got all the inflation protections, all the protections when you move jobs, and you put all that in, the fact is at that point, employers have voted with their feet and no longer provide pensions.
Shouldn't they be made to, maybe? Isn't it right that we shouldn't be eating cat food when we're old ladies and gentlemen?
Well, I don't... You can't... There was... This is where a contract has been broken. There was a very good deal in which companies used their best efforts and provided company pension schemes, but the obligations were not so onerous. So they were willing to run... The company pension scheme was one of the most sophisticated and successful forms of an intergenerational exchange. And I don't think you can rebuild it just by making the problem of the compulsory burdens on companies to deliver pensions even more onerous. It's the fact they've been made more onerous in the last 20 years that has provoked the problem.
And what about public sector pensions then?
Yeah, well, people have rights. I mean, first of all, people have now got contractual rights and have to be honoured. There is a genuine discussion about what is affordable, but the aim, and I'm obviously not in the government anymore, and I don't know, but all I can say is that in the Cabinet Committee discussions I participated in, the aim was to try to ensure that the cost of those pensions was open and fairly borne, including through contributions of employees, and also particularly to try to protect the pensions of people in the least well-paid jobs in the public service.
Pensions seems to be one of those things that are so incredibly important to us all, but and I'm sure you must see this not only from politicians but from civilians as well. People get scared and don't want to talk about it and put their head in the sand and think there's a bad thing coming, but I don't understand it and I don't want to talk about it. And people your age will often say, Jenny, I haven't got a pension, I'm never going to have one, I'm screwed.
Yeah, and I think that the problem that we've got is that this is sort of uncharted waters politically. I mean, it's like the discussion about the welfare state in general or healthcare reform or any of these things, that we are dealing in a new era and we're confronting problems that are new. You know, the 60s isn't going to come again. The baby boomers were a product of their time and place. You know, it wasn't just the size of them. It was also where they were born and, you know, and that, yeah, that interaction between the economic boom and what was going on politically and all the cultural trends, all of that, that happened then. You know, now things are very different. And I think what everyone is sort of trying to do in their own way is to find ways of making sense of these problems that we're trying to deal with at the moment. And, you know, as I said, I think it has to be quite carefully done because, I do think there is a risk of, in discussions about pensions or wages or whatever, coming back to something that you said before, Karen, making out the standard of living that people kind of enjoyed, only some people, by the way, back in the 60s, and let's not forget the 70s happened, you know, it wasn't quite rosy as a decade, by saying, oh, well, that's unattainable, so we should all settle for less. I think there's a risk of that. And I think there's a risk of granny mugging, to be honest. You hear these proposals, not from you, David, but from various sort of think tanks or organisations to kind of make these people who are living in the bed blockers, they're living in these kind of
these terrible
four-bedroom houses, they should move to smaller houses to make way for the young people, which is, I think, both very short-sighted and vicious. And I think if there's anything that really is posing a threat to the intergenerational contract, it's that kind of idea that we are opposed to our elders in this direct way. So that's why I think we just need to kind of really keep having this discussion and kind of look at the various things that are being kind of pushed into it.
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. I just make two comments on what Jenny just said. First of all, to reveal the fact that I do think these underlying demographic changes have more of an impact than Jenny would say. These cultural changes of the 60s, driven by several things. One is clearly the fact that we had a lot of young people. And Britain in the 1960s was a youthful society. It had the median age, the middle person in Britain, was a lot younger than the middle person now. So, and if you want to look at kind of predictors of civil war in developing countries turbulence in developing countries, these are countries where I list the countries where the middle person in the population is aged under 20. And it is Iraq and Somalia and Palestine. It is the world's trouble spot. So my view is that these cultural trends are partly driven by demographic reality. And then the second thing on the kind of granny bashing, The other side of it, which I experienced as a constituency MP, is a little old lady who comes to see you in your surgery and she says, I'm very scared, it's very dangerous. There's a dangerous gang of youths outside my flat. What am I going to do? The police aren't interested, they should be. And I'm cycling around the constituency or going past her flat. And I remember that lady came to see me. I'll check. Oh, yes, this is the gang. You find them. And it's a disconsolate group of youths.
Perhaps
they may have between them one can of cider. They're kind of under a bus shelter because it's raining. You ask them what they're doing. They said, we're bored. They may be a slightly sad group, but they're not actually going to rob and mug this little old lady looking nervously from her third floor flat down on them. And that tells me that there is not enough intergenerational exchange and communication anymore. And and sometimes, of course, what's really sad is that the lads, these gangs, know that the police are endlessly being called by a little old lady. And they get fed up with little old lady because they think they're being harassed by the police. The little old lady thinks that if she goes out, these guys will attack her. And it's just a catalogue of terrible generational misunderstandings.
And as you point out, people tend to operate now in their own generational cohort at work or in other organisations.
Exactly. We are more segregated by age. We live more of our lives with our own age group. And of course, the irony is that Jenny and the kind of school of sociology that she's been involved with and Frank Peretti have themselves warned about this problem of the way in which stranger danger can get out of control and adults don't feel that they can engage with kids in another way other than being the parent. So you do, it's partly that, which means that you end up in a society where you have broad flat networks of largely people your own age group, and it's only families which have gone in the opposite direction, where you have fewer siblings, when you're more you are more like, families have become more intergenerational, with more people of different ages and fewer of your own age. You've got intergenerational families in a age-segregated society. And that, I think, these tall, thin families in a flat, generationally segregated society, is a very peculiar social phenomenon, and I think it is part of the breeding ground for some of the cultural issues that Jenny describes in her book.
Because, of course, as you've said, you can't have the baby boomers demonized in the way that you could maybe with the other in terms of immigrants or criminals or single mothers if you don't know any of them. But if the face of that awful greedy baby boomer is your nan, you might there might be some hope that you will want to have more discussion between age cohorts rather than just fearing them as the other. Perhaps it's only the kind of thing that can work in heated commentariat discussions. And in the real world, things will get a little, you know, in terms of these sort of stoking of fires, will come up against the reality test.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the formalisation of relationships, both between generations and within generations, I do think is a huge problem here. Actually, in the way that David described in your book, in The Pinch, you give this wonderful anecdote about the mosquito, you know, that device that only teenagers get.
Yes.
Which you're absolutely right. I mean, it's awful. I mean, and it's almost sci-fi. And imagine if this was used on the grannies. Yeah, no one would get away with it. I completely agree with that. And you know, and I think that this kind of discussion about the problem of the baby boomers isn't making life easier for young people either. I mean, I think that's the issue, that part of the discussion about the problem with alleged boomer behaviour or values or any of these things is also a critique of youth. So you end up with this very weird thing.
Absolutely, where you've got, critiquing their this earlier, idea younger
of,
selves.
You know, the idea of sort of freedom and experimentation and all of that is seen as, oh, that's a bit irresponsible, that's very hedonistic, oh, that's really unhealthy. And so you've got these kids who are like ferried here, there and everywhere by cars. And, you know, they're in these formal kind of youth, I mean, football groups, which kids used to play football. You know, now they have to be part of a club. Everything is very, very tightly regulated. And this, I think, just makes these relationships much more brittle and much less amenable to that sort of intuitive kind of understanding and cooperation, which is, I think we both agree, is really what we want.
Now, before both of you are whisked away, can I just ask what the next book I can expect from each of you is? Jenny, what's next for you? What are you looking at? Research or a monograph? What do you want to look at next?
I would like to, I think, do something more on the sociology of generations that goes beyond the kind of particular study that I was able to do of the baby boomers.
Carl Mannheim would be proud.
Exactly. Well, because as you will know from having read the book, I'm a very big Mannheim fan.
But I also, think you've got another one here in the room.
But also things, certain things have moved on since he was writing. I mean, quite fundamental changes. So, for example, women are now part of generations in a way that I think in 1920 they really weren't. They just didn't play that role. You have the changing context of class and politics. That's all very different. And to sort of look at some of these deeper questions that actually David's been challenging me to look at, that would be a very kind of satisfying thing to do, to keep kind of looking at what we can bring from this field of the sociology of generations.
Well, we'll look for that. And as an early career scholar at King's College London, what are you aiming for in terms of a monograph?
I have already now a pamphlet for King's, which was the first thing I've written that has been subject to proper peer review.
How is that?
I got these reported comments from the supposedly anonymous peer review. I said, I don't agree with these guys. These are people, they're just disagreeing with me. And one of the academic supervisors said, yeah, that's the trouble with peer review. Often people get confused. They think they've got to agree with the comments of the peer review. If you just disagree with them, don't worry. So I had to tighten up the argument. But some of it, I thought, well, we should just have a disagreement. I'm now writing a book about universities, and I have just signed a contract with Oxford University Press to deliver something by early next year, and I'm enjoying writing a book which is not a ministerial memoir. I promise you it's not, but I try to draw on my experience as a minister, but I'm really trying to offer some kind of contemporary account of what a British university is like and how it shapes our education system as a whole.
You think it'll be the same by February as it is now?
The university?
Yes.
Oh, they've been going for a very long time. They'll be fine.
Thank you so much, Jenny, David, for joining me. Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.